Welcome to another broadcast of Unboxed. Today we have a special guest, Beth Yoey, who is the executive director of the Conflict Center in Denver, Colorado. Stick around as she talks about how she unboxes the power and the potential of her team.
I'm Dr. Robert Davis, family life educator and leadership coach. This is my co-host, R.P. Soriano. Soriano attended Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, worked in the financial industry, and was an international consultant before partnering with me to launch Unbox to Lead. Me? Well, I worked for over 20 years as a senior pastor and a community organizer. Then I retired and started a leader's peer support community called Unbox to Lead. Soriano and I have been friends since the early 90s, and with our varied experiences and expertise, we help leaders reach the next level in their leadership. So join us for the next few moments as we unbox the power and the potential of your relationships, your leadership, and your life.
Welcome back, wherever you are in this big wide world. We're so excited to be back with another broadcast of the Unboxed podcast, whatever you want to call it. But whatever you do, whatever you call it, we'd like you to be sure to like, subscribe, and share to your network the things that we're doing here, the exciting things that we're doing here in leadership. We're not going to waste any more time. We're going to kick this off. Like I said, we've got a very special guest today, and who is not only a colleague of Dr. Robert Davis, but is also a very good friend. So, Robert, I'm going to kick it over to you, and why don't you tell us a little bit about our guest today?
Man, thank you so much, Raphael. I am excited today. Beth Yoey is a good friend of mine. She and I have been working together for the last 2+ years around policing and public safety here in the Denver area. In just a moment, she's going to tell us a little bit about her organization. And she's been in this arena for a long time. I guess I'm kind of like Johnny come lately to the scene. She and I have been working together. She helped us to get the initiative started. She has been an integral and unbelievable partner throughout the entire process. And I'm just glad to know her and to be here with her today. And the reason, Raphael, and for everyone who's listening and watching, the reason that I asked her to be a guest today is because last week or so, she and I were at a open house for a nonprofit organization here in Denver that gives grants to organizations like Beth's and mine. And one of her employees, without me even soliciting, just volunteered and said how much she enjoys working for Beth and just the healthy workplace culture that Beth has created. And I said, man, that's who I've got to have come and present, because she has really tapped into unboxing the power and the potential of leadership. And so, Beth, good to have you. Let me just kick it off by asking you to tell us a little bit about your organization. What is it that you do? How are you changing this corner of the world?
Thanks so much, Dr. Davis. I'm really happy to be here, and it's lovely to hear that introduction. And then, my colleagues love working at the Conflict Center as well. And so that's always nice to hear, through the grapevine, and appreciate our opportunity to work together in the ways that we've gotten to know each other over the last couple of years. So the Conflict Center is a small nonprofit located in Denver, and our mission is to equip people with the practical skills and tools to embrace and transform everyday conflict. So we know that everyone has conflict. I was just talking to someone yesterday who was like, Conflict Center? Well, everybody has conflict. And I was like, absolutely, that's the point. Everyone has conflict, but many of us growing up or in our adulthood have not been given or taught the skills to address conflict in productive and effective ways. And at the Conflict Center, we believe conflict can be an opportunity to build relationships and solve problems when we're able to approach it in that way. And so all of our work falls in this sort of larger umbrella of transforming conflict. And we do it in a variety of ways. So classes, workshops, professional development. We have a number of school-based programs, including focusing on youth and teen dating violence, positive relationship building, restorative practices, which is an alternative to the punitive discipline system in the K through 12 school arena, as well as restorative justice, which is a part, we have in particular a partnership with the Denver District Attorney's Office, where cases are referred to us in a community-based process. And if the defendants in the legal system, they call defendants, we call them person who caused harm, goes through a community-based process. And when they've completed that, their case is dismissed and sealed. So we're off-repping people from the criminal legal system. And all, but all of those things are this idea of how do we reframe how we look at conflict and how we address situations in our community. So that's a little bit about what we do and our approach.
Man, and your community, your organization rather, is really making a profound impact on the community. But this is not where you first started. Anyone who wants to read her bio, please make sure that you visit theconflictcenter.org. Theconflictcenter.org. Did I say that web address correctly?
That's correct.
Conflictcenter.org. You can see her whole bio. But before you came to the Conflict Center, you worked with the Anti-Defamation League. Can you just give us a little bit about your work there and kind of how you transitioned into the Conflict Center? A little bit about your personal journey.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was at the ADL for many years in a variety of different positions, but the primarily focused on the anti-bias education arm, if you will, or a part of their work as a civil rights organization. So my background has been in education and training, especially adult learning, and particularly in what now we would call the justice, equity, diversity, inclusion space. When I first started, it was diversity and then anti-bias, but all in that space of how do we learn to better understand how systems of oppression work within the US context in particular. How do we look at our own learning and what we need to unlearn and address bias in ourselves, in institutions, and in systems? So I bring that perspective to the Conflict Center. We certainly understand that identity, bias, all of that impacts conflict and how we address conflict as well.
Rafael?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just absorbing all of this. This is incredible work that you are doing with the Conflict Center. I think we always talk about this at Unboxes, the importance of developing skills and getting the skills now. Probably for most of us, we're building these skills as adults, mm-hmm. but I see what you're doing and what your organization is doing is trying to get these skills into the minds and the hearts of young people before they reach adulthood. And then they realize that they have absolutely no skills to deal with conflict. Like, you know, that's kind of the case for most of us. So tell us a little bit though about your background as far as how your, because one of the things that we do focus on here or that we take a look at with regard to leadership is how our family histories and our family backgrounds have impacted our work as leaders. You feel comfortable talking a little bit about, you know, kind of your family background and if that, the impact, if any, that that had in getting you to where you are today?
Sure, happy to. And before I launch into that, just a little piece, I think I see it, our work as a both and. So we certainly want to work with youth and recognize building those skills and I'm a firm believer that adults always have the capacity to learn and grow and build new skills. So we try to hold both of those pieces. So in terms of my background and my family, I was born in Iowa, but I grew up in Texas in the Dallas area, a suburb of Dallas. And looking back, I recognize the different pieces and the seeds that were planted for me in with my immediate family and with my experiences that I didn't necessarily recognize when I was a kid. But as I grew and really embarked on my own journey of understanding race and oppression and all of the isms in college, recognized that those seeds and just the a real ethos of how we treat people, how we interact with people, recognizing and honoring different people's differences, those messages came to me in sort of subtle ways growing up. So I don't necessarily, like many white folks and many white families, I don't necessarily remember talking about race. There's definitely a culture, especially in the United States, that to be not be racist means you don't talk about race. So it wasn't as overt, but we definitely had conversations about inequity, even if we didn't use that language, and what was going on around us, and paying attention to, you know, where those struggles were in society and those kinds of things. And so that piece certainly impacted me as I got older and had more of ability to put language to my experiences.
I'm a little curious, if I can just tell you just one second, because you said something that I'm a little curious about. You said that you didn't talk about race overtly as a family. And yet as a leader, one of the main things that you have to deal with is around race. I'm wondering, and you may not even have the answer. I wonder why it is that some families are not as comfortable talking about race, even when they're having conversations about equity and justice and fairness and things of that nature.
Yeah, I think some of it was the times, right? I grew up in the 70s and early 80s. And what my experience has been with a lot of white folks is that there's been a dominant culture piece that the way that we become not racist is not to talk about race, right? Like to, you know, sort of that colorblind philosophy. And so I really had to, and I don't know that my parents, like, or my friends, family, you know, parents or people in our community necessarily could articulate that that's what was happening. But I know a lot of people, that's the message that we get. So I had to unpack a lot of that starting in college and, you know, coming out of college to recognize that what was happening is by not talking about race, it wasn't doing anything to address racism. It was keeping us from being able to really have those conversations and talk about things in a much more clear way. But I experienced a lot of folks who grew up with that. Or if they talked about race, it was sort of in this general, like, everybody's equal, treat everyone the same kind of piece. That
we're all God's children.
Right, exactly. Yeah. We all bleed, you know, all of us have red blood. You know, those kinds of messages that on the surface seem lovely, but really miss the opportunity, because if we don't talk about race, then we can't talk about disparities in education you know, the school to prison pipeline and all these things that we, disproportionality, all these things that we know are happening. And we need to have the clear language to talk about how it's really playing out and who benefits from the systems and who doesn't. So now I'd say it was a learning process for everyone. Now we do have those conversations with my family. My parents talk about race. I talk, you know, with many family members. And then in our own family, with my husband and my children, we talk very explicitly about racism and sexism and homophobia and, you know, all of the isms, and try to give a different kind of understanding and language around being able to navigate the world and recognize where we have privileges, where we might be disadvantaged because of systemic discrimination.
Did you have a follow-up?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so you talk about some of these things happening kind of subtly throughout the course of your life, and you kind of just came to this awakening. Were there any particular leaders, public figures, whether they were specifically dealing with this particular issue or outside of that, that you would point to and say, ah, that was the person, or those were the people who really, really inspired me and made me want to get into the area that you're in, whether we would know them, you know, whether they're famous or they're, or, you know, just people who just kind of crossed your path.
For sure. I think there's a couple of different arcs to that journey. I remember I was a big reader when I was a kid. And I remember in middle school, probably sixth or seventh grade, we had to choose a biography, you know, and read a biography and write a report about a person. And I remember finding a book in the library about Coretta Scott King. And that was one of my first entrees into learning about the civil rights movement, about women's contributions, all those pieces. And that really opened my eyes and I think a really interest in a desire to learn more and understand more. And so continued to read. I remember being really moved by things going on in our country at the time, like the AIDS crisis, or Ryan White, who was a young boy who got AIDS from a blood transfusion, and how poorly he was treated. And some of those things that just felt like got me, you know, like stuck with me in terms of inequities. I don't know that I called it that, but something not seeming fair or right. And so then when I was in college, I was really fortunate to find some leaders, as you're talking about, in some places to really build on that interest and kind of spark more and have a more fully formed understanding of and beginning that real journey of self-reflection and those kinds of things. I got involved in what was at the time called the Department of Multicultural Services at Texas A&M University. That's where I went to school.
Okay.
And so Texas A&M has a strong emphasis on what they call the other education. That's like service and student leadership and things like that. And so I did a number of different things, but really was attracted to the Department of Multicultural Services. And they had just started this peer education program. And a woman named Sherry Schmidt was the director of that program. It's called UACT, University Awareness for Cultural Togetherness. And that's really what led me on my path. I have no doubt. So I learned, you know, many of these pieces kind of got put together and understanding more clearly what was going on systemically. But I also learned how to facilitation. We did, you know, peer-led facilitation and all these different kinds of workshops. I was influenced by other folks, like the head of the department at the time. His name was Kevin Carruthers. Tanya Williams was a graduate student at the time there. And so these folks really helped me grow as a person. Those experiences helped me grow. During college, I went on a civil rights tour through a variety of the different places in the South. And John Lewis was and continues to be, even after his passing, like one of my, in the people names people know, like a true personal hero, and was really impacted by him, especially when I was in college, because I was looking at someone who was a young person during the civil rights movement and really had a leadership role and was putting himself on the line and fighting for something, you know, that was about himself, but much bigger than him as well. And so all of that, I think, really cemented my passions and avocation in this area. And then I launched from there.
As I hear you say that, I'm thinking about a young person, because we always tell young people, you know, find a mentor, find someone who you admire and learn from them. And sometimes it's really not as easy as just walking to someone and saying, hey, will you mentor me? And you mentioned several names of individuals that had impacts on your life. And I'm thinking specifically at the ones that you interacted with on the university level. How did you interact with those that you found to be inspirational, that you wanted to learn from, perhaps even emulate? How did you approach a mentorship? Was it official type of mentorship, or what was your method of learning and gleaning from these individuals?
Yeah, I was really fortunate, because since I got involved in those student organizations, the mentorship kind of just came with it. Right. So it was part and parcel of the whole experience of being involved in those different different organizations that were learning experiences. And so they became mentors of mine sort of by default. And I'm really very fortunate. I still have relationships with both Sherry and Tanya. Like, they are still dear friends. And Tanya and I still work together some around, you know, in DEI space. We're both faculty members for the Social Justice Training Institute. So those are relationships that I was fortunate to form and have mentorship in college, but they are ties that I've kept throughout my life.
So it's a very organic process is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing you say.
For sure. Yeah, it was definitely more organic just by the things that I chose to get involved in.
You know, it's very interesting and inspiring to hear you reference civil rights movement and that particularly quintessential American activity that is in my mind, the civil rights movement is, if you want to look and point to what America is about, what America is in its, at its darkest and at its best, it is the civil rights movement. It is everything that is American about America. Protest, fighting for equality, thinking about all of the things that America can be, America being able to look at itself critically and say we can do better. So hearing you say that is, I don't know, it's quite inspiring. I mean, I just think that a lot of times we talk about the civil rights movement, we talk about civil rights leaders, without seeing the nuance, seeing that this is actually what America is, and how inspiring that can be for all Americans and not just BIPOC Americans per se, right? It is an American movement and should be seen that way. And I seeing that kind of starting to make these connections here in your work with equality, it makes sense that you would kind of find your way into dealing with conflict, because that's really at the heart of all of this, right? And developing that skill is being able to address and deal with conflict. So I had a question there somewhere in there. And I'm sure it'll come to me. I was going somewhere with that, I promise.
Well, I tell you what, the place that I was thinking about as she was talking about the various leaders and as you mentioned about conflict, I'm curious just to what your philosophy, your leadership philosophy is just as a whole, or what is your leadership vision for your own personal leadership? I'm curious, as you look at all of the individuals that have had an influence on you, what would you consider to be your leadership philosophy?
Thanks for asking. I'm not sure that I have a philosophy that's like nice and tied up in a bow. Here's my philosophy, but I do have some tenets that I think are important and that have developed over time that I've definitely learned and grown into and continuing to grow. So that's one of my pieces of philosophy, of my approach, is I believe that we are all lifelong learners and we all have the opportunity to grow and continue to improve and understand. And so I try to come from that open space and engaging with people and recognizing the places where I can learn. Second, I would say over time, I've developed more of a leadership style that recognizes that people have many talents, and I want to be both a leader and create the kind of environment that creates a space for people to nurture those talents, to find talents that maybe they didn't even know they had, and to really take ownership of the areas that are, you know, either if it's part of their job or a project or whatever that they really feel like they can take the lead and take ownership. And that means that my leadership style is more hands-off. So not in a sense that they don't get support. I think every people need support. They need, and part of the challenge is recognizing what kind of support and the level of support each individual needs. And it means that it's not about saying, here's what needs to be done and here's exactly how you do it, right? It's here's what needs to be done. And I believe and trust that you know how to do it. And it may not be the way that I would do it, but you know, this is where we want to get to. And if you can get to that end point and in the ways that make sense to you and probably think of things that I haven't thought of, then that's great. And so creating space for that, creating sense of, and also a sense that of trial, that we can try things. We can, I say a lot, that perfect is the enemy of good, right? That we're not going for perfect. There's no such thing as perfect, that our work is dynamic. So we try our hardest and do good work and recognize that. And 6 months from now, we might be like, oh, we got to tweak this or, oh, this, you know, things have changed or what have you, that we can do that and we can try things out.
Let me jump in for just 1 second, because you said something that really, really touched. Just our last week broadcast, Raphael and I were discussing equality. What does equality really mean? And you hit on something I thought was so profound. When we talk about it, and even with Unbox to Lead, what we try to help leaders to understand is not to overfunction. And by that is to take an equality posture, which means I trust that you are competent to handle what needs to be handled. And I think and that's one of the things that I heard your employee say when we were at the meeting, which was, hey, she doesn't stand over our shoulders. She doesn't micromanage us. She trusts us to do our job. And that really resonated with me. Mm-hmm. I have been in positions where I have been the micromanager. That's what been one of my shortcomings of leadership. I have been in the position where I have been micromanaged. Nobody likes that. Yeah. So that is tremendous. I'm wondering, how did you, and please don't forget your other points, but I'm sure you're back, and we're going to come back to them. But I'm wondering, how does a leader get to that place, considering that we're aiming for productivity? There's still goals and things that we're trying to accomplish. And how does a leader get to a place of calmness and assuredness that they're not overbearing, micromanaging their team?
Well, I think some of it is communication, and I know that I'm not always perfect. Well, I just said perfect isn't the goal, but I sometimes.
Well, that's a good cop out, Beth.
I for sure make mistakes in this area, but what I try to do is really communicate up front. Like, here's the expectations, big picture, like the, you know, the container for it, or here's when this needs to be done, or here's our timeline, or here's what I see are the priorities in terms of what needs to happen. Right. So I, you know, it's not just like, oh, you know, whatever, go do whatever. There's some container there that then people can operate in. And then we have conversations if there's a piece of like, oh, you know, what's going on? We really needed this, you know, we really needed this done on Friday here, you know, so that we can meet these other pieces. So I think it's part of that. I think some of that is trying as hard as possible to be really transparent around the whys. Like, if there is a set thing that needs to happen in a certain way or by a certain time, that we explain the why instead of just saying, because, you know, like the parents.
Well, that's it, so.
No kind of thing, right? That I think it helps when people have an understanding of the context around it and where that's coming from. Like I said, I'm not always great at it. I also know that I tend to think pretty quickly and I'll have already moved on. Like, oh, this is a challenge, boop, 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 boop. Let's do this. And, you know, and sometimes forget to go back and be like, okay, here's why I think this and here's how I got to that and those kinds of things. And I do think that's helpful. But I think as long as people have enough information that you've set them up for success, then I don't have those like panic moments very often. And we can get there. There's also the piece of me of recognizing, and you know, of course our work is important. I wouldn't do it if I didn't think it was. And it's not brain surgery, right? It's not like a life-saving measure. So we have space that we don't have to create a false sense of urgency. right? Mm-hmm. So we can take a breath and say, okay, that didn't get quite done the way we wanted, or we missed this piece. How do we learn from it and move on, right? So that we have a lot of conversations of like, oh, well, that was good learning for next time, right? Oh, yeah, that didn't quite work. And that we own our mistakes. So that's the other piece, is that we have, that I want and try very hard to create a culture where people don't feel like they have to come up with excuses, right? Or, you know, they can just say, I messed up, or this took longer than I thought, or I didn't plan accordingly. And so we can work through it and we can learn from it. So those are some of the things. And that's not to say that there aren't times when I don't get like, oh, but I try not to, and I try to create from the beginning, putting the things in place so that we can be successful and not get to that. The downside is, I'll, you know, own with that kind of leadership, there are times that it might take me a little longer to figure out, oh, this isn't going well. This person doesn't have the skill set that I thought they did in order to succeed, or what have you. And then we have to back up a little bit, or say, okay, let's talk this through. What's happening here? Let's give me some more information. How did you approach this? What needs to be in place? Is it training? Is it other things? You know, those kinds of things. And so you have to be okay with that. You have to be okay with that. That's the trade-off when you're not micromanaging.
Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, the last point on that is, it also depends on the person, right? So sometimes I realize that I'm working with someone who does really want more structure.
Wow.
Right? Or there are particular things in our program that do require particular like process for very good reasons, right? Like, and so making sure that those things are in place is also important, or adjusting when someone does need more structure and recognizing that the hands-off isn't working for them. It's not a one-size-fits-all.
Yeah, you said exactly what I was going to chime in and say, so I'm glad that you said it. We officially call that situational leadership.
Yeah. Right?
This idea that there are some people at various points in their career that need, because I don't want us to jump on micromanagers too hard, because sometimes they are very much needed, especially if you have someone who's brand new,
right,
comes into your organization for the first time, and they're very, you know, they're very excited, they want to do a good job, but they need a lot of hand holding. Mm-hmm. And I think for the hands-off leader, that's the hardest thing to do a lot of times, right? Mm-hmm. Is to say, I would rather just this person come in and I just give them kind of a broad outline and they should just be able to run with it. And that tends to lead to a lot of frustration on both sides. Mm-hmm. Person isn't really clear on what they need to do, or they don't really understand the organization very well. They don't understand the environment very well. And so they're given these broad parameters and they're trying to figure it out, and they're frustrated, and the leader sees that the work hasn't been done, and then they get frustrated. And then on the complete opposite, you have those people who have been in your organization for years. They could run it if you needed them to run it. They could do everything with their eyes closed. They tend to need a challenge. They tend to like autonomy. Mm-hmm. So they're not going to be micromanaged. They're going to fight that tooth and nail. Those are that. I think what you're describing perfectly is situational leadership, and mm-hmm. I think a lot of times what is not accounted for as leaders is the amount of energy that you need.
Oh yeah.
The amount of energy that you need to become that kind of, almost even transitioning and moving fluidly from leader to manager, which are two different, skill sets as well. So it's good to hear that. Did you want to chime in? Because I have another question loaded from the last rambling that I.
keep ramble away, ramble away.
I don't want to ramble. But we, one of the things that we focus on with our organization is we try to get leaders to think about understand that their personal lives also have an impact on their leadership. So, could you think about or talk a little bit about maybe a personal, not too personal, because we don't want to, we don't want to make it uncomfortable, but something that's happened in your life that was not work related, that was quite a challenge, that actually, parlayed into your leadership, whether it helped you to be more empathetic for your team, because you had personally dealt with it, or something else that maybe had built some resilience that you were able to take as a lesson for your leadership in your professional life.
Yeah, thanks. You know, I think when I think about this question, what comes to mind is that there are personal challenges and just situations that are always informing my work and approach, right? I don't know that I have this one, this thing happened and, you know, and because of that, I've learned X, Y, and Z. But I think it's more, if I think back all along the way, challenges I've had with friends or you know, relationships that fell apart, right? Or people who, you know, I thought we were in one space and I'm addressing a concern I have and they, you know, just ghost, you know, to use current language, or unfriend or whatever, you know. But and then really having to think through and, oh, what just happened there? I can see these elements, right, in these pieces. So when we're talking about it in a workshop or we're training, or I'm thinking about how I'm going to approach a difficult conversation with a colleague, what can I learn from the times that it didn't work well? I also think there are times when I've had situations that didn't go the way I wanted, and the learning has been recognizing what is mine to own, what is not mine, right? Because people often want to put their stuff on you and say, here, you take this and this is all on you. And getting to that space of like, okay, I could have done these things better and I am not responsible for their choice to do X, Y, or Z. And so those pieces have certainly helped me learn and grow. Certainly my own experiences where I've stepped in it around race or learning, you know, transgender or messed up pronouns or whatever it is in my personal life, absolutely impact then how I show up as a leader and the grace that I give other folks, but also the things that I can learn from that of what do you do when you get called out, right? And how do you do that with humility instead of defensiveness? And so I can think of the times when I was totally defensive, right? And I didn't do it well. So I don't have a big like, oh, this situation happened, but I think it's a whole combination of pieces. And certainly the times when I didn't speak up or I didn't say things, and those are the conversations that play over and over in my head, you know, even years later of I wish I had said this or I wish I had done that. And so learning from those as well.
Well, that's extremely insightful, because I think that that's one of the challenges that people in leadership or people in high profile positions deal with. And that is, we walk on this razor's edge now in society where if you take three breaths instead of four, you run the risk of being canceled. You run the risk of being, you know, there's all of this outrage. And, you know, can you talk about that just a little bit about, you know, intentions and your sincere desire to actually help? But, you know, what are the pitfalls, if any? What you're describing is the way society really should be. And that is, there should be grace. We're all trying. If we're coming from a place where we haven't talked about race, we start talking about race, of course, that's going to be dynamic. That's going to be sloppy. But we also are on the kind of opposite where people jump all over you and you just kind of decide, well, I'm not going to have this conversation now, because either if I don't have the conversation, I'm in trouble. If I do have the conversation, I'm in trouble. So how can we become a more, you know, what are some steps to becoming a more gracious society as we tackle and deal with some of these tough issues? And it doesn't always have to be race. I mean, it could be any kind of, you know, work issue that's happening, you know, a dysfunctional situation at work or whatever the case may be. You talk a little bit about defensiveness and all of these things. What's the quick cliff notes that I can go take and put in practice with my wife here in the next hour or so that our marriage can survive? And I know Robert's ears are perked up for sure when I say that.
There's a lot of different types of situations that you just wrote, right? And I would say, I think as a society, part of our challenges is we don't do nuance very well, right? And recognizing the complexities of situations, and that there isn't just two sides. There's all sorts of pieces that if we really want to understand and engage with other people, that we have to be willing to entertain. We also are not good at the both and, right? It's either or. Yeah. So either you're, if I'm right, then if you don't agree with me, you have to be wrong. Either you agree with me or you fight me, as my friend Eva will explain about that dynamic, right? Like, there's not a space for holding multiple truths, multiple ideas, being able to be in the space where it's messy, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's what happens, is people don't really like messy. It's much easier to have these spaces. And it's much, and in many ways, I understand some of it's identity development, some of it's just our society. But we end up in these strident places because it's much easier to just be firm in our belief that we are right. And if you don't fit in this space, then you're wrong. And I'm going to tell you, and I feel like I'm doing this great thing by, you know, calling you out. And to me, we have these conversations about how does this play out? And for me, one of the things is looking at our motivations and intentions. Mm-hmm. So our motivation in doing that is really to, like, look like a good person, right? White folks fall into this a lot. Other dominant identities, you can fall in this place of, I want to prove that I'm the good white person, right? And I'm going to do that by calling out other white people and shaming them and all of those things. That's not a productive motivation, right?
Right.
And there's lots of other less productive motivations of why we're engaging. If my motivation is just to be right, or to make you look bad, or, you know, or if I have a motivation just to ignore the conflict, those kinds of things, we can find ourselves in those spaces. I think the challenge we're definitely in a space right now where there's lots of tension and that polarization in this space of, you know, I'm in this and you're there and we're separate. And there's not a lot of willingness to see ourselves in others. And part of me gets it, right? Like, there is some really terrible rhetoric, right? And some, you know, really stark differences. And when we engage in that, I firmly believe that that's what the system wants us to do. We're replicating the system when we are in that either or thinking, when we avoid nuance. So even if we're using progressive language, even if we're like standing up for what we feel is right, if we do it in a way that doesn't allow space for others to make mistakes, as you were saying, to try, that only, you know, only shames and blames, I think we're replicating the system, the dominant culture system, and keeping things in place. And so it's ironic because it's probably the exact opposite of what people are purporting to want to be doing. And I think if we're really honest with ourselves, we all have biases. We all make mistakes. And I think we're much more effective if we see ourselves in other people and can recognize when we've made those mistakes, like, how did I learn that? Right. How did I get to this space? Mm-hmm. Right? And who helped me along, and what obligation then do I have to someone else to at least engage in that conversation? And it may not go anywhere. And this is especially for folks who are not being targeted, right? So I'm thinking, as a white person, as a man, if we're dealing with sexism, as someone who's straight, if we're dealing with anti-LGBT, right? If you're the target, your safety, all those things come into place. But in the supporter space, what responsibility do we have to engage rather than to push away? To have those hard conversations, to recognize that there might be some nuance or space or multiple ways of thinking of things. And then to your point about intent versus impact, we absolutely have to look at impact. We often are in a space, I think, where we say, oh, but I didn't mean to, right? As a way to exonerate ourselves, or I didn't intend that.
Right.
But you can hold both. You can assume people have, you know, good intent until they prove you otherwise, but you can assume they have good intent and still hold them accountable. And I think if we can find a way to do that in a way that brings people in so that I can say, hey, Robert, I know you and I've heard you speak and about this issue, and I know that your values are X, and I don't think you intended to have this impact. And what you said really bothered me. I felt, you know, it had sexist implications, and I'd love to talk to you about it. That's very different, right, approach, but I can still hold them accountable.
Yeah.
And I think that to the skill part, we don't have that skill piece. And especially when we're heightened or we're frustrated or we're upset, we lose those skills, right? We operate more from that fight mode or the flight mode, as you know, the F's that we know of. So that was a long answer to your question.
No, it was a very great answer.
Very good.
One of the things that, just to your point that you brought out a moment ago, one of the things that jumps in my mind is that when, because I do, you know, I do a lot of teaching, as you already know, Beth, I do a lot of teaching and stuff around racial sensitivity and things of that nature. And one of the things that I have come to over the last several years, and I believe you heard me say this in other forums, is what have I been taught as a man who was born in the 70s, became self-aware in the 80s, became of age in the 90s, who was a big fan of the A-Team and Knight Rider and all these other, you know, heavy macho shows that really portrayed women as kind of like the utility of a man. Mm-hmm. Her purpose is to satisfy me, you know, and to satisfy the star of the show, which in my case is me. I'm the star of my own show. And so when I sit down and say, okay, what were the messages that I was taught? What are the signals that were sent to me? It helps me to be able to understand and to sympathize with someone who's white in America, who the very first time they ever saw a picture of Jesus, he was white. The first picture of a pretty baby they saw was white. You know, all those images and things, just like the images that came to me about what is the role of a man, what is the purpose of a woman, all those different things, at the same way that I have to kind of flush through and say, okay, this is what I was taught from in my formative years, but this is who I want to be. I have to be patient with others who, you know, are also going through whatever that process is for them. Mm-hmm. So I know that may have kind of taken us a little off subject, but man, that was something that really jumped in my mind. I was so glad to hear you say
that. I totally resonate with that. And that's in a way what I meant by like seeing ourselves. We have to see ourselves in others, and then you approach it differently. And I think you're right. In our society, if we start from a baseline that we all have bias,
yes.
Right? And we all have bias because we've all absorbed it in the way you're talking about media, education, growing up, you know, our own experiences, but how that, you know, they've been framed in a certain way for us. It's the air we breathe. It's the fog, you know. And so if we recognize that, then we recognize that we all can fall prey to it. Right. And it's work to unlearn it. And I believe part of our responsibility is to work and hold each other accountable in ways where we're unlearning together, right? Like to recognize the work as a collective, and to avoid the trap of, oh, look how great I am, right? I've unlearned this. How could you still believe that? Versus, you know, let's engage in where can I see myself in you? Which is, I think, exactly what you said so beautifully about your own learning and unlearning.
I think that definitely helps in having conversations with people. I mean, I've personally lived many, many lives, and there are people that I cannot relate to now, but I don't write them off as being, you know, I don't want to give any clues about who I'm referencing here, because I don't want to get into a political discussion or anything like that. But I can easily say that I can understand why they think the way they think, why they are processing things the way that they're processing them. And this is not about being stupid, because I think that's the first knee-jerk reaction we have with people who have a different opinion or different ideas than our own, is that they're either not enlightened or they're not smart enough or they're uneducated or they're stupid. And I don't take that approach. I take that approach of, hey, I can understand where they're coming from. I've been there and I understand what messages they're getting. Just like what Robert said. I mean, if you grew up watching these, you know, machismo television shows and listening to the music that we grew up listening to, of course we don't hold those ideals and beliefs now, but if we're to bump into someone or have a conversation with someone who does, we should be able to come from the perspective of, hey, I know why you believe that. I understand that.
And I want to take this a step further, Raphael. Please don't forget your point. And that is, I also want to be conscious of what I was taught, because even though I may say to myself, hey, listen, I don't think that way anymore. And I may not think that way anymore overtly or consciously, but there are so many signals that have been stored in the back of my mind.
You can revert back to it.
Can revert back. So when it comes time for hiring practices, when it comes time to interacting with a woman that I consider to be, you know, physically attractive, am I reverting back to some of those old, you know, signals, those old messages that I learned, or have I really overcome? And then sometimes, you know, we do right because of the consequences. Well, this is a great conversation today. Sometimes we do right because of the consequences, but it isn't because we really hold it in our heart. So, you know, the consequences now is that I'm not supposed, you know, if I pat the secretary on the buttocks, I'm gonna get fired and my whole firm's gonna get sued. But what if I live back in the madmen times? If I could build a time clock and go back, would I still be that same person? Or is it just because I live in a society now where I don't want to get my pantsuit off, where I don't want to go to jail for assault? You see where I'm coming from?
Yeah,
and
for sure.
The more that we wrestle with the truth of who we really are, the truth of how we really think and function, I think that helps us to become more of the leader that we want, desire to be, the more we become real with what we've been taught. Right. And the principles that we want to exude.
Yeah, I think I totally understand what you're saying, Robert. And there are pieces, and we're seeing, right, in our discourse right now, people are saying things that 5-10 years ago you wouldn't hear in public as much as you do now, right? So there's clearly some folks who, like, that would lay dormant until it felt like they could do that again. Yeah. And I think there are people who, like you're talking about your own experience, are unlearning pieces, right? And part of the unlearning can be these expectations around behavior. So when I worked at ADL, one of our tenants for the World of Difference Institute was good behavior is better than bad behavior. Now, good and bad is too much of a dichotomy, but you get the idea, right? That sometimes we have to compel the behavior and then the attitudes actually come along after. Mm. And I think that we get so focused on, I've got to change this person's mind, which is not possible. We are not capable of changing anybody's mind. They have to change it themselves, right? But we can, in certain circumstances, compel certain behavior and say, these are our expectations and our beliefs. That's what I think part of good leadership is. And then people, through that experience, may begin to have those more like, okay. And that reckoning that you're talking about, that you just, you know, that all three of us have had in different parts of our lives. So I think there's a complexity to it, but that piece is important. And that's part of what I see as an important part of leadership is being really clear. Mm-hmm. This is our culture. This is our expectations. Because if you don't create, culture is created in organizations or anywhere, regardless, but it's either done intentionally or unintentionally. And so part of my goal is to be really intentional about this. This is the culture. These are my expectations. Let's build, what are our expectations together of each other? What does that look like? So we spend a lot of time at the Conflict Center amongst staff talking about what culture looks like, what values look like to us, you know, because even though we use the same word, we might have different definitions of it. Like all of that of setting the stage that then includes behavior and practicing our skills and those kinds of things. So
And we had a set of questions that we wanted to ask around to do a case study, if you will. But I want to just kind of throw a shameless plug in here, because I'm so glad you talked about culture, because one of the things that we are attempting to do at Unbox to Lead is to help leaders to be more intentional mm-hmm. about creating a healthy workplace culture, a place where your team wants to be, a place where your team wants to grow. And I'm so glad that you have come in and joined us today to have this conversation. Raphael, I believe you have a closing question for us. We wanted to go into a case study, so we've got to get you back, Beth, so we can actually do a case study with you. But I'm going to let Raphael close us out with our last question before we move on.
So this has been, Beth, this has been fantastic.
It really has.
This could easily be a 2+ hour show listening to your insight, and especially when you're dealing with nuance, right? Because mm-hmm. That's when you fall down the rabbit holes for the most, yep. for the most part, when it's not black and white. But for leaders out there, whether they're leading a small nonprofit or whether they're leading a Fortune 500 company, I think you are definitely qualified and capable to offer some counsel or some advice on, for someone who is entering leadership. Perhaps that young college student, such as mm-hmm. yourself, who entered into a community organization and is getting ready to step out onto the precipice of leadership. What advice or counsel would you give them?
That's a great question. I'd say trust in others and recognize that if you have a team, you should treat them as a team, and that and work together to solve problems, engage in culture building, all of those things. Balancing that with recognizing that there are times where you do have to be the one to make the decision, and it's sometimes a trial and error process, but learning that piece and recognizing to take in people's voices and making decisions, not just based on your own ego or defensiveness. You don't know everything, and you're never going to know everything. So humility is a big one. And don't be afraid to ask questions or find other people to connect with. I think that often, especially as young leaders, there's a sense of, I have to know everything. I have to show up a certain way. And there are cultural pressures to do that. And I think we fail leaders when we set them up for that. And find other people, find Dr. Davis, find folks in this podcast to ask questions. And what do you think? And I'm struggling with this, and being willing to do that organically. And the last thing I would say is, don't forget about culture building, that as a leader, meetings with your staff, team meetings, we often say, oh, I had all these meetings, so I didn't get any work done. That is work. Those are the work. Building relationships with your staff and modeling that your staff build relationships with each other is part of the work. And that took me a long time to get to, and now I really embrace it. But recognizing the importance of those pieces.
I think we just got a 45-second masterclass in leadership. That was
This has been a complete masterclass in leadership from the word go. I love the term you use, and I'm going to I'm going to plagiarize you right now. So I'm giving you fair warning that I will be plagiarizing you, which is to model the type of relationships that you want your team to have. I love that. Model the type of relationships you want your team to have. And just like Animal Farm, it's going to start off with your name attached to it, and then slowly but surely it'll morph its way into Robert Davis's thoughts.
Right. So what I hear Dr. Davis said.
As he reverts back to his sexist past and exploitive behavior.
I'm absolutely sure that there are things that I now share and say that I know that I got from wisdom of others that along the way have morphed and I've forgotten. So it's all good.
Before we close out, you've got a lot of great things happening at your organization. Is the quickest, surefire way to get that information is just to visit your website?
Absolutely. Conflictcenter.org. So it's super easy. We have a lot of opportunities for volunteering. If you're interested in restorative justice, especially, that's a volunteer community-based or process, but we have lots of other ways for people to plug in and get involved, and you can take classes. It's all there on the website.
That's fantastic. Fantastic. Well, that has been our, this is a good place to wrap it up, unless Robert, you have anything else you want to say, contribute, add, or ask. Well, this has been a wonderful show. I hope everyone out there has enjoyed it. Beth, thank you so much for your insight, for your wisdom. I've walked away a better person, and I'm sure everyone listening to this broadcast has as well. So on behalf of Dr. Davis, I'm R.P. Soriano. This has been another broadcast of Unboxed. Thank you for joining us.
Unboxed provides a full-service leaders peer support community that helps high-level leaders become more authentic leaders who build healthy workplace cultures and reach their personal life goals. To learn more and discover how we can take your leadership and your life to the next level, please visit our website at unboxedtolead.com. That's unboxed, the number two, lead.com. Again, that's unboxed, the number two, to lead.com.